Welcome to Faith and Family, a radio outreach of Family Life Center International. Join Steve Wood and his guests for a lively discussion about your faith and your family. You can become a part of this broadcast by calling toll-free 1-800-994-2050. And now, from Greenville, South Carolina, here's your host, Steve Wood.
Hello, this is Steve Wood, and welcome to Faith and Family. I'd like to thank you for joining us today. About half past the hour, we're going to be taking your calls as well as some email questions. If you send an email question, try to keep it brief. And those questions you can send anytime during the broadcast to askthehost@gmail.com. That's askthehost@gmail.com. As we get a little closer to the half hour, I'll be giving out that 800 number for you a couple of times so you'll have an opportunity to call. Today we have a great guest. In fact, he has been a guest on Faith and Family, and some of our most popular radio shows over the years have been with our guest today, Roy Shulman, who is author of the book Salvation is from the Jews, subtitled The Role of Judaism in Salvation History from Abraham to the Second Coming. Roy is also the author of a second book, also published by Ignatius Press, entitled Honey from the Rock, 16 Jews Find the Sweetness of Christ. Roy Shulman, welcome again to Faith and Family.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, you know, it's been too long since we've had you on, and I think our listening audience has literally doubled, at least the number of stations has doubled since I've had you on, Roy. So as we get into our topic today, it's really, let's start with your story. What's your background, particularly starting with your boyhood, your college and teaching career, and then your conversion experiences? Can you just kind of step us through all that?
Sure, I'd love to. Well, I was born and raised Jewish. In fact, both of my parents are German-Jewish Holocaust refugees who fled Hitler's Germany, obviously, fortunately, got out in time. I was raised in a suburb of New York City in an entirely Jewish environment, and my Judaism was the center of my identity and my world. And in those days, things were a little bit different from now. All my parents' friends were Jewish. You know, the two worlds were more separated than they are now. And I went to Jewish religious education all the way from the beginning of schooling in first grade until I left for college, and took my Judaism very seriously, had quite a devout nature. I was blessed by being mentored by some very extraordinary rabbis. In fact, the summer between high school and college, I toyed with the idea. I was the disciple at the time of a Hasidic rabbi, who are the ultra-Orthodox, you know, with the ear curls. And I was traveling with him in Israel and toyed with the idea of entering essentially Jewish religious life in a yeshiva in Israel, but I didn't do that. I went back home and started university. I lost my faith. I went to MIT. I pretty much lost my faith in college, mostly under the influence of the kind of contemporary science has all the answers, religion is a medieval superstition, and the intellectual arrogance, which characterizes all too much of academia. And so by the time I got out of MIT, I was essentially atheist. I went on to Harvard Business School. I did well enough there to be invited back to join the faculty. I found myself on the faculty of Harvard Business School as a newly minted professor of marketing at the ripe old age of 29. And that's really where my conversion story begins, because what happened was all my life since I was a small child, I had felt there has to be a real meaning and purpose to life. There is a real meaning and purpose to life. And it would come when I got older and came into a personal relationship with God, which I really thought would happen at my bar mitzvah, which is like the Catholic confirmation when the Jewish boy is 13 years old. He goes through a religious ceremony where he enters religious adulthood. I really thought that during that ceremony, the veil would drop and I would come into a personal relationship with God. And when that didn't happen, it was actually one of the saddest days of my childhood. Then pretty soon I decided the real meaning and purpose of life would come when I got a driver's license, or when I got a girlfriend, or when I left home, or when I began college, and so forth. But here I was already at this time more successful than I had ever hoped to be in a worldly sense, being a professor at Harvard. But life still had no meaning or purpose. So the bottom fell out of my world, and I was actually in the deepest despair of my life. And it was in that kind of existential despair that I was just walking in nature early one morning, alone in these, like, small pine woods behind the sand dunes on Cape Cod, when I received the most spectacular grace in my life. I was just walking along, lost in my thoughts. I had long since put behind me taking God seriously in any way. And from one moment to the next, the veil between earth and heaven dropped, and I found myself in the presence of God, very knowingly in the presence of God, in intimate communion with Him, and seeing my life as though I had died and was looking back over my life after death in the presence of God. And I saw in an instant how I would feel about everything, what I would be happy about and what I would wish I had done differently.
What give us an example of maybe a couple of those things, both the positive and the negative, looking back.
Well, first of all, I was very aware that my two greatest regrets after I died would be, number one, all of the time and energy I had wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in an ocean of love greater than I ever imagined could exist, coming from this all-knowing, all-loving God who was in my presence at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the other great regret would be every hour I had wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven, because I saw that it's really true that everything we do has a moral content that's weighed in the balance and recorded for all eternity. And very literally, we will be rewarded for all eternity for every right choice. And every opportunity that we let slip through our hands will be a lost opportunity for all eternity. And I saw that very vividly. And so, you know, I basically, from one moment to the next, I knew the meaning and purpose of my life, and I knew what to go after and what to aim for and what mattered and what didn't matter. As I said, here at the time, I was a marketing professor at Harvard Business School, and I felt like all my life I had been working for monopoly money when I could have been working for solid gold coins. In other words, laying up riches for the kingdom of heaven, which mm-hmm. would be the real currency which lasted for all eternity, instead of working for things which wouldn't matter at all even 100 years from now, much less 100 million years from now.
So tell us about this experience, though. I mean, how long, well, of course, when you're in the presence of eternity, I guess time, so to speak, loses its sequential nature.
I was time.
Okay. How long did it last?
It lasted, I'd say about 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay.
What happened was I was still walking at the time. It was a, needless to say, an amazing experience. It had a quality of intellectual vision in the sense that I could not hold the question in my mind without being shown the answer. So basically, as my thoughts went to one theological issue after another, the answer was immediately and vividly presented to me. So, for instance, I saw everything about divine providence, how everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged, designed specifically for me, coming from the hands of an all-knowing, all-loving God, not only including those things that had caused the most suffering and that I had thought of as the greatest disasters at the time, but especially those things that had caused the most suffering. I saw that there was never any reason to be at all anxious about anything, because everything was being totally controlled and guided for my own true good by an all-powerful God. I saw, of course, that the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve my Lord and God and Master who was revealing himself to me. But what I didn't know was his name and what religion to follow.
Okay, that was going to be my question. So you didn't get clarity, I assume, as far as what path to take specifically to find this God who just revealed himself to you?
Well, I prayed to know his name at the time so I would know what religion to follow.
Okay.
And I remember praying, let me know your name so I know what religion to follow to worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become Buddhist, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian.
Okay.
And I actually remember praying that, so
okay.
I think that's the reason he didn't reveal his name to me. It was because I was saying I wasn't ready to hear that.
Well, you know, I have actually told people that God is truly the perfect gentleman. I mean, he waits for our will to be receptive.
Yes, and I mean, because of what I mentioned earlier, my parents being Holocaust refugees, the kind of worldview I grew up in as Christianity being the enemy and this great threatening force suppressing Jews and Judaism, I obviously wasn't ready to hear that, and he respected that.
Okay. Well, take us to the next step in your life.
So as you asked, I mean, the immediacy of the experience lasted about 45 minutes or an hour. What happened was I was still walking at the time, and eventually I walked into an area where there were other people. And when other people started coming into the picture, that state of consciousness faded and actually went away. But I went back home to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I was living at the time, happy for the first time since childhood. I knew it was all true. I knew we lived forever. I knew there was never any reason to be anxious about anything. And I knew the meaning and purpose of my life, and all I wanted to do was pursue this experience. So I didn't know what to do with it, because here I had had a mystical experience. It was nothing like anything I had ever heard of or read about, because I had grown up Jewish and then became atheist, so I didn't know about the mystical experiences of the saints and so forth. So all I could decide to do was find a mystic to go talk to find out more about this experience.
Okay.
So I basically just looked up a mystic to talk to, which wasn't a very prudent thing to do in Cambridge in the 1980s.
I guess so.
And he was obviously, he was into the New Age and into all this, you know, Hindu meditation and stuff. And he pointed me in some pretty unhealthy paths, which I spun my wheels for about 6 months looking into. But at the same time, I was doing a good thing, which is every night before going to sleep, I would say a short prayer I had made up to know the name of my Lord and Master and God who had revealed himself to me.
Mm.
And a year after that first experience, I went to sleep after saying that prayer. And I thought I was woken by a hand gently on my shoulder and led to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could ever imagine. And just to be in her presence, to feel the purity and intensity of the love flowing from her, was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I ever imagined could exist. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. When I found myself in her presence, all I wanted to do was throw myself on my knees and somehow honor her appropriately. I was just overwhelmed with her, both her grandeur and with her love. And the first thing she said to me was she offered to answer any questions I might have for her. Now, at this point, I knew it was the Blessed Virgin Mary without being told. There was a lot of infused knowledge in both this experience and in the earlier experience, so I just knew it was her. So when she offered to answer any question I had for her, the first thought that crossed my mind was, oh, my gosh, I wish I at least knew the Hail Mary so I could somehow honor her appropriately, but I didn't. So I kind of wanted to ask her to teach me the Hail Mary, but I was too proud to admit that I didn't know it. So instead, my first question to her was, what's your favorite prayer to you? As a kind of backdoor way of getting her to teach me the Hail Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Well, her initial response was a little bit coy. It was, I love all prayers to me. But I was a little bit pushy. Maybe that's because I'm a New York Jew and maybe not. But I said, but you must love some prayers to you more than others. And she relented and she recited a prayer to me. The prayer was in Portuguese and I didn't know any Portuguese. So all I could do was make the effort to remember it phonetically. And the next morning when I woke up, I wrote down the first few words phonetically. And later I asked a Portuguese Catholic woman to recite all of the Marian prayers in Portuguese so I could try to identify it. And to the best of my ability, I identified it as, O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us, have recourse to thee. Anyway, she...
Roy, I have to interject a question. Do you think there's any significance that that was in Portuguese?
Yeah, I two dimensions to that. One is I knew at the time, as she was saying it in Portuguese, as part of the infused knowledge, that one of the reasons it was in Portuguese was because in saying it in Portuguese, she was carrying with it a certain childlike trust in and devotion to Mary that the Portuguese people, or the people,
mm-hmm.
had held on to more than many others. The other dimension to that is I short-circuited some of my story because I can spend 2 hours just telling, you know, the events of what happened. But that mystic that I had initially visited to find out more about my experience, when I was with him, he had a coffee table book on his coffee table that I glanced at called, like, The 100 Greatest Miracles of Modern Times, and one of the pages was devoted to the miracle at Fatima, which which I had never heard about, despite having spent about 25 years in higher schooling. And it placed a seed in the back of my mind that this thing really happened at Fatima, and that I never actually completely left my mind. So I think that might have been another reason why it was in Portuguese.
Okay. All right. Well, forgive me for interrupting you, but I think that's an interesting aspect. Continue with your journey.
Sure. Well, since she said I could ask her any questions I wanted, I asked her about four or five more questions, and she graciously answered them. And then the audience was ended. Actually, after the questions and answers, she said she had something she wanted to speak to me about, and she spoke to me about another 15 minutes telling me something. I don't have the same kind of absolute waking memory of that later part of the experience with her. And then the audience was ended. I went back to sleep. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I know now that what happened took place while I was asleep, and that my body was still asleep in bed, and that, strictly speaking, it was a dream, although a dream unlike any other I ever experienced. At the time, I thought I was awake, and my memory represents it as though I was awake, but now I realize that that's not strictly accurate. So anyway, the next morning when I woke up, I knew it had been Christ on the beach. I wanted nothing other than to be as fully and completely Christian as possible, although I didn't know what that meant and what the difference between a Protestant and a Catholic was. But I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was, and I knew her role in the relationship between God and man. So that led me pretty directly to the Catholic Church. So about 2 years later, after a couple of more blind alleys, I was very gratefully received into the Catholic Church.
Well, let's talk about the relationship between Judaism and Catholicism, because if we have any Jewish listeners to the broadcast, and we do occasionally have Jewish listeners, as well as many Christian listeners, you know, in the popular mind, Christianity is kind of a Gentile religion. So, and I know you don't feel that's the case, but what is the relationship between Judaism and Catholicism?
Sure, because that's exactly what was my puzzlement when I entered the Catholic Church, was what are all these Gentile Catholics doing, thinking that Catholicism is like a new religion for the Gentiles. It's obviously the fulfillment and continuation of Judaism. Let me just put in a little plug, which is, as you know, I wrote a book about this called Salvationists from the Jews, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show. It's also the title of my website, salvationistsfromthejews.com. And I wrote that book precisely because when I came into the church, I looked around and I didn't understand why the whole church didn't see Catholicism as a continuation of Judaism.
Yeah, I mean, isn't Jesus almost conceived of as a Gentile? I'm talking about it in the popular mind. Everybody knows he's Jewish and had Jewish mother, but isn't he kind of conceived of like he's a Gentile?
Absolutely. I had an Irish friend who yelled at me and said the title of the book should be Salvationist from the Irish. I gave a Passover Seder, a Catholic Passover Seder at a local Catholic parish, and one of the parishioners stormed to the pastor saying, "How dare you let this man in and claim that Jesus was Jewish?" But I agree completely, but I mean, it just seems totally obvious to me that, it's all one story. It's a story that begins in the Garden of Eden with the fall of Adam. When God initially created man, the intention, in some sense, was for man to live in a state of continuous intimacy with God and bliss, you know, no suffering, no death, and so forth, from his creation for all eternity. When man fell, that initial relationship between God and man was ruptured. God knew at that very moment that at some future point in time, he would not only restore man to the initial exalted state into which he was created, but actually raise him to a far more elevated state through the incarnation of the second person of the Most Holy Trinity as a man at some future point in time, at which point the divine nature and the human nature would coexist in the second person of the Most Holy Trinity and elevate human nature to a far greater status than it had in Adam. Now, if the second person of the Most Holy Trinity was going to incarnate at some future point in time, it would be among a particular people, at a particular place in the world, at a particular point in time, even in the womb of a particular virgin, and that people would have to be prepared. And that's what the Jewish people were. They were the people chosen from all the people on the earth to be prepared to host the coming of God as man. if they were going to host the coming of God as man, they had to be separated out from all the other people wandering the face of the earth. They had to be kept separate for almost 2,000 years, given a tremendous amount of divine revelation, taught about the one true God, taught to worship him, taught about the creation of man, the fall of man, the seriousness of sin, the need for redemption, the future coming of a redeemer, and so forth. Given enough divine revelation to recognize the Redeemer when he came, and given enough foundation in theology to spread the gospel to the four corners of the earth after he came. And that's what the Jewish people were. They were chosen for this task. But by the very nature of that task, it was never intended just for them. They were to be a vehicle for bringing salvation to all of mankind. So the special relationship that God gave to the Jews to prepare for the incarnation would be extended to all of mankind through the church, through faith in Jesus, through the sacraments of the Catholic Church, once he came. And so it's all one story with one tremendous pivot point at the center of creation history, which is the incarnation, at which point the promise of Judaism and the role of Judaism was in some sense fulfilled in literally bringing salvation to the whole world, to all mankind, through the Catholic Church.
So I'm sure somebody listening, or perhaps somebody has even said to you, well, Roy, you have abandoned your heritage. You would strongly deny that.
I mean, I would argue that does not make any sense whatsoever. If I was Jewish before, I mean, all of Judaism was about the promise of the coming of the Messiah. Orthodox Jews today, they pray three times a day, you know, for the coming of the Messiah, and that they believe fervently that the Messiah will come any day. If Judaism is about the coming of the Messiah, and Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, how did I become less Jewish by becoming a Jewish follower of the Jewish Messiah?
Exactly. So even today, I mean, there are those trying to be kind and ecumenical and such will say, well, Jews are Jews, Christians are Christians, and saying we don't really need to extend the gospel in a charitable manner to our Jewish friends. What would you say to that?
I would say if Jesus agreed with you, he would have died of old age and dead, because he got crucified for spreading the gospel to Jews. He didn't get crucified for spreading it to Romans.
Okay. All right. So you're really seeing your Catholicism as a fulfillment, really not a switch from or a leaving Judaism in any manner whatsoever.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to offend anybody, and some of my best friends are still Jews who just think I'm crazy. But I would argue that the only way really to genuinely be completely a faithful Jew is to be in the Catholic Church, to be a sacramental member of the Church. Because that is the fulfillment of Judaism. Jesus was a Jewish Messiah. How can you be completely faithful as a Jew if you're denying the person who actually was the Jewish Messiah?
And if I can just jump back for a moment, those desires you had as a boy, the desires you had for your bar mitzvah, if I can put words in your mouth, you tell me, are now fulfilled in what you've found in the faith in Jesus as the Messiah.
In spades, and that's actually the heart of the matter is that whole story of my growing up was a yearning for a personal relationship with God. In my wildest dreams, I had no idea of the intensity and depth and richness of a personal relationship with God, which is made possible through faith in Jesus and made possible through the sacraments of the Catholic Church. It far exceeds my wildest hopes and dreams. And if you read Jewish literature, which I still love, like Hasidic literature, it's full of a yearning for a personal knowledge of God, a personal relationship, and these tiny trickles. And they make such a huge deal out of the tiny trickles because a tiny trickle of intimacy with God still blows away everything on earth. But my heart goes out to them because it is such a tiny trickle compared to what any, frankly, Catholic in a state of grace has available to him.
All right, we're going to go to a break in just a second, but I want to tell our listeners at familylifecenter.net, look at that home page, click on the listener resources in the radio box. You can get a link to Roy Shoman's website as well as his book, Salvation is from the Jews, and more information about what we're talking about in this show. But stay with us. We've got some very interesting topics right after the break. This is Steve Wood with Faith and Family.
And now, a Faith and Family Minute with Steve Wood.
Both parents and priests are rightly concerned about 20-year-olds quitting the practice of their faith. Researcher George Barna reports that 60% of 20-somethings who were involved in a church during their teen years failed to translate that into an active church life as young adults. There is a massive faith washout during the critical transition years. How can this faith washout be prevented? The scriptures highlight the role of the father. Fathers have the ability to influence the faith life of not only their children, but of future generations of their family as well. Psalm 78 teaches that when a man instructs his children in the faith, he is also passing on the faith to his grandchildren and great-grandchildren who are not yet born. When he personally instructs his children, a father not only conveys the content of the faith in a way that really sticks, but he also models the world's best teaching method. A son will grow up to follow the example of his father and take the time to teach the faith to his children as well. This is God's timeless plan for passing on the faith within a family for generations. Psalm 78 says, God commanded our fathers to teach their children, that the next generation might arise and tell them to their children. Teens don't have to grow up and abandon the faith, so long as the faith of their fathers has been passed on to them.
For more Faith and Family resources with Steve Wood, visit www.familylifecenter.net.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Steve Wood, and today my guest is Roy Shulman. He is author of the book, Salvation is from the Jews, The Role of Judaism in Salvation History, From Abraham to the Second Coming. And if you visit familylifecenter.net today and every week, we have resources for our listeners. Look for the radio box, click on Listener Resources, you can get a CD of today's show, how to get a copy of Roy's book, Salvation is from the Jews, Roy Shulman's website, and some other articles that you might find very interesting. Roy, we covered, so to speak, the part of your book from Abraham to the Messiah, to the coming of Christ in the first half of the show. If I could kind of switch gears a little bit, and this was one aspect of your book that initially caught my attention in a rather significant way. Let's talk about the role of Jews and the place of Jews between the first coming and the second coming of Christ.
Sure. That's obviously why the subtitle was From Abraham to the Second Coming, was precisely to kind of intrigue people with that. It's very interesting to me because in the early days of the church, it wasn't clear that Judaism still had a role to play in salvation history. Although there are hints of it, and there are hints of it in Scripture, and there are hints of it in what Jesus said, which I'll go into. But in addition to what we know from Scripture, and now what we know from teaching, there's also the last 2,000 years of history, which also tells us quite a bit about the role of Jews and Judaism in the second phase of salvation history, that is, between the Incarnation and the Second Coming. First of all, I guess I'd start a little bit backwards with the historical aspect, which is I think that if one just looks at the last 2,000 years of world history, there are a couple of strange things about Jews and Judaism which jump out at one. The first is that they still exist, that Jews and Judaism still exists, despite the fact that for almost 2,000 years they had no homeland and no geographic center. If you read the pages of the Old Testament, it's full of a lot of tribes in the Middle East in those days, the Edomites and the Jebusites and the Hittites and so forth, far more numerous and powerful than the Jews, but none of them have, appear today anymore. Pope Benedict he wrote some beautiful things in his book, God and the World, precisely about this, that the existence of the Jewish people today as an identifiable people is in itself a visible manifestation of a miracle of God. So that introduces the question of why do they still exist? And there's another thing about the last 2,000 years of history which is very telling, which is essentially the mystery of anti-Semitism. Most people have been hated by someone somewhere at some point in time, somewhere in the world, but there are not a lot of people who have been hated everywhere at all points in time, everywhere in the world, for almost 2,000 years, like the animosity directed towards the Jews. So I would argue that that animosity directed towards the Jews itself gives us some very direct hints about their continuing role in salvation history. Now, with that as the kind of backdrop, let me jump to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. The paragraph 674 of the New Catechism says, the glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every point of history until his recognition by all Israel. And I think that actually holds the key to the whole mystery. What that paragraph is saying and you know, what it goes on to explain in more detail is that the second coming can't come about until there's a large-scale conversion of the Jews. Now, if that's true, that the second coming can't happen until there's a large-scale conversion of the Jews, which we know as Catholics from the Catechism, but we can also know from the passages in Scripture that that paragraph in the Catechism reference, that suggests at least one reason why, actually it suggests two reasons why the devil might be hell-bent on destroying the Jews. One is that if there are no Jews, there can be no second coming. And the other is if he can prevent the conversion of the Jews, there can be no second coming.
Well, in fact, you have a section in your book, I think it's entitled The Diabolical Motivation Behind the Holocaust, and you dig right into this.
That's exactly right. It's almost 100 pages in the book revolves around this because, I mean, growing up, the Holocaust, frankly, the Holocaust is the central theological mystery of Judaism, you know, beginning with the second half of the 20th century, because Judaism always taught that the Jews are the chosen people, that God is all-powerful, that he has a special love for the Jews, and that he controls what happens in the world. And it's kind of hard to integrate all of that with the experience of the Holocaust. So, of course, it was at the center of my consciousness. When I discovered all of this as a Catholic, for the first time in my life, the Holocaust made sense because, A, if you look at the spiritual forces that led to the Holocaust, they're directly diabolical. And we can talk about that, but there were three directly satanic streams that merged and sort of flowered into the attempt to exterminate the Jews.
Okay, one, two, and three.
One, two, and three. Occultism,
okay.
Or what we call now the New Age.
Yes.
Sexual depravity.
Yes.
And eugenics, or Planned Parenthood, or however one wants to refer to that.
Which are now worldwide.
Which are now worldwide, which have now reemerged to a more heightened degree than they did even in Weimar Germany leading up to the Holocaust. And all three of which can be very directly seen as motivating impulses behind the Holocaust itself on the one end, and on the other end can be directly seen as flowing directly from the pits of hell. I'll go back there. I mean, I'm happy to go back there, but I'll just kind of finish the initial thought, which is, so for the first time, the Holocaust made sense, because here it was a direct expression of the satanic will aimed at exterminating the Jews. Why should Satan care so much about exterminating Jews? Well, maybe he cared so much about exterminating the Jews in order to prevent the Second Coming. And maybe the Holocaust came about now as a kind of almost last-ditch attempt to, excuse the expression, abort the Second Coming.
Hmm. Well, I have a thought in my mind, and it's kind of like a seesaw. On the one hand are the televangelist who's saying, you know, the second coming is going to be next week and always keeps you on the edge of your seat. Kind of the other end of the seesaw, and I think Catholics might be a little bit more guilty of this than they should be, is kind of like, well, we don't want to be like them, so we're not going to really even contemplate that people could be growing in the world to such a degree that we could be looking at events that would be leading up to the event of all events.
I think there are at least two good reasons to take the Second Coming very seriously in the end of the world. One is, as Catholics, it's dogma. I mean, we know it. We know it's going to happen. We know that this world was not intended to last forever. And we actually know that the true meaning of everything in this world is only found in its implications for eternity. And that's absolutely huge. It obviously changes your life when that actually makes the journey from the head to the heart and you actually live that way. There's nothing, the importance of everything in the world, the importance of everything we hold dear, really lies in its implications for eternity. Because we are going, every human soul who's created is going to live for more than hundreds of millions of years, including hundreds of millions of years after the physical world as we know it passes away. So the whole kind of understanding of the meaning of life shifts. Another reason why it's really important to take seriously the Second Coming is there is a tendency, especially when things get bad, including today in the state of the culture, state of the world, the state of morality and so forth, to feel that somehow God has been deposed from his throne and things are running amok and are out of control of God. And that's a terrible way to think. It negates true faith. I mean, God is absolutely sovereign, and nothing happens that's outside of his will. And that's, at the heart of the nature of God, and so it's at the heart of the nature of faith. If you take the Second Coming seriously, if you take the Book of Revelation seriously, if you take the Church teaching about what will precede the Second Coming seriously, you'll see that as part of divine providence, God will allow things to look awfully, awfully, awfully bad in the world. Much worse than we can imagine, much worse than what we're seeing now. And what that does is it arms us to look around at the state of the world, whatever it is, and say, oh, this doesn't mean that God is out of control. The very least worst it could mean is that we're coming close to the Second Coming.
In fact, you had cited, Roy, 674 of the Catechism, where it speaks about the Second Coming will not precede the conversion, large-scale conversion of the Jews. And then the very next paragraph, 675, tells us what to expect. And this is part of God's plan. So I have a question for you, and this is in your book. And I remember the first time I picked up your book. I get a lot of books from publishers across my desk. And I remember the first time flipping through and coming to a halt. And I can't say for certain, but I think it might have been a comment on this passage. And I like to refer our listeners to Luke chapter 21. And it's kind of an important passage. And, Roy, you're one of my very, very, very few Catholic friends I can even broach such a question. But it says this, starting in verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, for these are the days of vengeance to fulfill all that is written. And it speaks here about the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD, and pretty much everybody's in agreement with that. But it says in verse 24, this is after the destruction of Jerusalem. Again, this is 70 AD, Titus and the Romans came in. Verse 24, they will fall by the edge of the sword, led captive among all nations, and Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. That verse 24 could have immense significance for our generation.
Absolutely, because as you point out, the beginning of that verse is fulfilled in 70 AD when Jerusalem fell. They will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations. Literally true, because the Jews were led into slavery captive and distributed among all nations at the time of the fall of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles, again literally fulfilled. The Jews were banned from Jerusalem under pain of death at that point under the Romans. And Jerusalem was held in Gentile hands continuously from then until 1967 AD, when for the first time in almost 2,000 years, Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem, were turned to Jewish hands. So that's a pretty sobering time clock. And then as the verse you read continues, Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And then the immediate next verse is a description of the Second Coming. And there will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth distress of nations and perplexity of the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting with fear and with foreboding of what is coming on the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. and then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. So that's a pretty telling time clock.
It certainly is, and it's kind of one that, I have a study Bible in front of me, and after it says, until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, it references Romans chapter 11, which is that chapter which speaks of, you know, the redemptive history as a vine, and organically engrafted in covenant engrafted in that vine are the Jews, that the Gentiles are kind of the second stage of that, but redemptive history will end with the Jews being converted. So along with what you kind of mentioned earlier when we began the topic of eschatology, there's one other event that has to happen before the second coming, and I'm flipping my Bible here to 2 Thessalonians, where St. Paul says, starting in chapter 2, verse 1, he says, now concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, don't be quickly shaken in mind or excited to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Let no one deceive you in any way, for that day will not come unless the rebellion or apostasy, I believe in the original Greek, the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed. So it's saying there's going to be a massive conversion of the Jews, but it also speaks of a worldwide rebellion, a falling away, an apostasy. Is this talking about the Gentiles?
Yeah, and if I can just like underline what you said, the Catechism of the Council of Trent stated dogmatically, quote, the sacred scriptures inform us that the general judgment will be preceded by three principal signs, the preaching of the gospel throughout the world, a falling away from the faith, and the coming of the Antichrist. And that falling away from the faith is generally referred to as the great apostasy that you're alluding to. But if I could take like 3 minutes with that Romans 11, sketches out exactly what you're describing. Because there's this mystery that of how many Jews did not recognize Christ, is a mystery of the Jews' rejection of Christ. And I hear that a lot from well-meaning Catholics. You know, how come Jews aren't able to see it's so obvious that Jesus was the Messiah? So let me say what St. Paul says. He says, I'm reading from Romans 11, starting with verse 7, but skipping some verses. What then? Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened, as it is written. God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see. So St. Paul is saying that the failure of the Jews to recognize Christ wasn't entirely their own fault, but it was actually a mysterious part of divine providence. But then he goes on later in the chapter, and he says, lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. So he's painting this picture where essentially the first phase of salvation history was God revealing himself to the Jews. The second phase of salvation history is, speaking with a very broad brush, God veiling the eyes of the Jews while the full number of the Gentiles come into the church. And then the final phase is the veil over the eyes of the Jews being removed, the Jews entering the church, and the church at that point composed of Jew and Gentile being complete and being ready for the second coming. And St. Paul talks a little bit about why God arranges this way. And he says, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. So he's saying that it was the failure of the Jews to recognize Christ was necessary for salvation to flow correctly to the Gentiles. You see this in the book of Acts, that the first crisis in the church, because the early church is all Jews, right, the first couple of years of the church were all Jews. Pentecost Sunday, when 3,000 came into the church, they were all Jews. All of the disciples were Jews. All of the apostles were Jews and so forth. The first crisis in the church was, can we let Gentiles into the church?
Right.
Was the church only for Jews? Obviously, the failure of the Jews to recognize Christ opened the doors for bringing in the Gentiles. Pretty soon, the church looked at least as Gentile as it did Jewish. But so St. Paul says, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. But then he says, now if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? For if their rejection means the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? So he's saying, look, if the Jews' rejection of Jesus meant the reconciliation of the whole Gentile world to God, how much more will their inclusion mean? What will it mean but life from the dead? And I think that when he's using the phrase life from the dead, to me, I tie it together with the great apostasy. So the picture is, in this last phase of salvation history, when the full number of the Gentiles come in, there will begin to be a falling away of the Gentiles. There'll be this great apostasy. There'll be a tremendous loss of faith. And at that point, that kind of number of Gentiles who have fallen away will in some sense be counterbalanced by the flood of Jews into the church. And that'll be the light from the dead.
You know, Roy, I'm honestly more optimistic for the Jews at this point in history than I am for the Gentiles, in the sense that, I mean, a lot of people have looked back, say, over the last 50 years and seen the course of the Gentile world, but I'm thinking even since we initially did some broadcasts together shortly after the year 2000 and such, and just what has transpired in 10 years, I'm talking about the degeneracy of our culture and the increasing velocity of that, it really gives one pause when you think the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Jerusalem will be back in the hands of the Jews. Now, I don't know. They may lose control of it again. I mean, I can't say, but it does seem to think that coinciding with Jerusalem back in the hands of the Jews, this is Luke 21, 24, and Paul then is saying, you know, don't boast, don't become proud, because God's not going to spare you, because he didn't spare the natural branches. And there's a certain pride and presumption, perhaps, on the heart of Gentile Christian world that maybe we should kind of awaken ourselves to the status of what we could be facing.
I absolutely. I think that it's dangerous times. It's dangerous times for everybody, and certainly people who have had the truth and walked away from it are probably in a worse situation than people who were never given the gift of the faith to begin with.
Or I think particularly with young people today, like when you said you were in college and, you know, you engaged in the things going on back then and, you know, you became an atheist, there's an odd thing going on today where a lot of young people who would classify themselves as Christians might have been doing the things that maybe you and I did in our youth and are embarrassed of, but they say that somehow this is compatible with living a Christian life.
No, that's true. This is I think that what's unique about our times isn't the prevalence of sin, but for the first time, black is being taught as white and white is being taught as black, and the teaching has been reversed so that, frankly, things that were always considered sinful, even if they were engaged in, are now being preached as virtuous, and if one should quote the Bible to condemn them, one is condemned as being uncharitable and unchristian and in some countries criminal.
This is the strong delusion, the darkening over the mind. I've got one last area I'd like to talk with you about, Roy, that's on the front page of every newspaper for the last several years, and that's Islam. I think as a Jew, you could bring some perspective about Islam. In fact, I heard one of my contemporaries, right, on EW10 radio, speaking about, you know, we all worship the same God. And, you know, in a way I can understand, yes, Muslim religion is a monotheistic religion. Judaism is a monotheistic religion, as well as Christianity. But I get a little comfortable when you start putting all these three major world religions in the same basket. Could you comment on that?
Sure. Let me start with that quote that you started with, of we all worship the same God.
Mm-hmm.
When I had that experience, that initial experience of Christ, and
mm-hmm.
I said, you know, okay, you're my Lord and Master and God. I don't care who you are as long as you're not Christ. On the one hand, I was worshiping Christ, and on the other hand, I was saying that whoever it was, it certainly wasn't Christ. I think that, in a sense, we all do worship the same God if our hearts are good, whether we know who that God is or not. so I will grant, and I actually believe very firmly, that a good-hearted Muslim, when he's worshiping Allah, is worshiping the one true God. However, that doesn't mean that the source of the revelation of Islam is God or a good angel, because it obviously can't be, because the revelation of Islam in the Quran denies Christianity. It denies that Jesus died on the cross. It denies that God has a son. It says anyone who describes partners to God has indeed committed a terrible sin, and so forth. So if Islam is based on revelation, the source of the revelation is clearly not God. Well, then, what is the source of the revelation? Well, maybe it's of just human origin, but if it's actually of spiritual origin, and I think that if you look at the history of Islam and the life of Muhammad, it certainly seems like it was a supernatural source or a preternatural source. That source is obviously a spiritual being pretending to be God who isn't God. And we know that spiritual beings who pretend to be God but aren't are not really good news.
Yes. And, well, I guess the temporal sequence of when the revelation came as well, because there's a certain ignorance that God overlooked prior to the coming of Christ, and particularly the world outside of Judaism. But after the coming of Christ, there's no new revelation from heaven, the like of which Islam claims for itself.
Well, there certainly is no new revelation from heaven that denies, flatly denies Christianity. It's telling. I mean, the revelation of Islam came in a part of the world which was peopled by Jews and Christians and pagans. And the people who Muhammad initially addressed to become his followers some percentage of them were pagans, but a huge number were Jews and Christians.
Mm.
So it was a purported revelation that came in direct contradiction to what we know was true revelation.
Roy, you have a lot of information on your website. We just have a half a minute left, but give out your web address and tell folks just a little bit what's up there.
Sure. It's www.salvationisfromthejews.com. Salvation is from the Jews is all one word. I have information on my books. I have information on the spiritual sources of the Holocaust, information on Islam, information on the relationship between Islam and the Nazis and the Holocaust. I have lots of Jewish Catholic witness testimonies, both up in audio and in written form, just celebrating the joy of Jews who have found the truth of the Catholic.
Okay. Roy, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us with Faith and Family.
Faith and Family is a radio outreach of Family Life Center International. Visit us online at familylifecenter.net. To order a CD copy of today's broadcast, order online at www.familylifecenter.net.